Welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Chris Shunk, and joined with me as usual is Dan Roth. Dan, what's up?
Good evening.
And we've got Sam Abul. Sam, and Sam, what's going on?
Hey, it's another humid night here in Michigan.
All right, we've got plenty of interesting topics to talk about, as well as the redesign of Autoblog, which happens with more and more frequency. But first, we're going to start with the Autoblog Garage and you, Dan. What do you have?
Today is my last full day with the Jetta TDI Sport Wagon.
Did you book that thing for a month?
No. I've had several Jetta TDIs. This is the third. I had one back a while ago with the... it was a sedan with the 6-speed. Then I had a sedan with the DSG. And now the sedan, the wagon with the 6-speed. They're all quite delightful to drive. And I can't think of a competitor for the price that's a better car. You know, some might say that they lack excitement, but excitement's not all to be had above 5,000 RPM. They do their thing, and they do it quite well. So,
but the important thing is that Sam hates this car. Oh, wait, you bought one.
I love the Jetta TDI, and actually I did put down a deposit on one today, although looks like it's going to be a couple of months before I get it, because there's this weird thing. If you've ever tried to buy a Volkswagen in the summertime, especially one that a popular model like the Jetta TDI, generally ain't happening too much. And it's especially now if you're happen to be trying to cash in on the clunkers deal. Essentially, there's almost no Jetta TDIs to be had anywhere in the United States right now. So I've had to put down a deposit on the first one that comes off, the first of the 2010s that comes off the truck when they start arriving. According to the guy at the dealership, apparently the problem is over in Germany, and actually this is throughout much of Western Europe, they generally take the month of August off. Everybody goes on vacation for the whole month of August, so there's almost no production. And even though the Jettas are assembled in Mexico, the engines, the diesel engines, come from Germany. So with no engines, they can't build cars. So that means no cars get built till September. And you know, by the time they show up at the dealers, it's October. So I have to wait a bit.
You know, why is it that Europeans tend to get a little testy with Americans? I mean, obviously, it's not because we have the money, because they're the ones having all the fun. They take month vacations, and you know, in some countries, they still have siestas, for crying out loud. We just work all the time.
That's because we're idiots.
We're the idiots.
they've figured out that you know, that if they're actually, you know, willing to, you know, pay a little bit more in taxes, they can do things like, you know, take a month off for vacation and get health care and those sorts of things.
All right. Before we devolve into politics blog. Yeah,
but I'm just saying I could use a month-long vacation without having a job the next month after that. But all right. Sam, what do you have this week?
Just finishing up. It's my last day with the Nissan Cube. It's going back tomorrow in exchange for a VW CC. And in general, I kind of like the Cube. You know, it's the packaging. You know, the thing is, you know, if you look at shapes, you know, a cube in terms of getting the maximum volume within given dimensions, a cube is, you know, about the maximum space inside that you're going to get within a certain outer dimensions. You know, if you push everything out to the corners, you get more room inside than you do in, say, a round shape. And that works out really well, you know, for a small, relatively small car, to hold, you know, four or even five adults, you know, in quite comfortable environment. And it's got some neat little features inside there, like the bungee cords on the armrests and things like that. Getting pretty decent gas mileage, about 27 miles per gallon. The one major flaw that I see with the Cube is on the highway, I'm hearing a lot of wind noise. You know, the wind is just roaring around the A-pillars on both sides. And I double-check the doors to make sure they're closed, and they're closed and sealing properly. It's just a lot of wind noise. A lot more than I saw on either the Scion XB or the Kia Soul.
Yeah, and the Kia Soul is not a quiet vehicle. It's a little rowdy on the highway, I found.
Yeah, it is, but it's a fun ride, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's like
absolutely.
A high-pitched hum, and you could deal with it. It's like you tune the radio a certain way that you don't even hear it after a while, but anything louder than that, it starts to get pretty impractical.
Yeah.
First, the one other thing that I think probably most people would find a flaw in this particular Cube is the CVT gearbox. Well, CVT transmission, let's put it that way. It's not really a gearbox. It, unlike some other CVTs from Nissan, this one is programmed to go up to, depending on however much throttle you give it, to go up to a certain engine speed and hold it there. So you've got constant engine speed as the vehicle's accelerating, and it's continuously changing the gear ratio. And that does tend to get a bit annoying, especially if you're accelerating moderately hard. It'll run up to 3,500 RPM and sit there for quite a few seconds before it starts to settle down.
Yeah, that's kind of a small engine, too, so it's sort of overtaxed when you're trying to drive aggressively. So.
You don't want to drive aggressively in a cube. I mean, it handles and rides really reasonably well, but it's definitely not a sporting vehicle. It's the same 1.8 liter engine that's in the Versa.
Yeah, okay. So
now, Sam, that car is, I mean, they target younger people with that car. How does that car play with your daughter and son? What do they think of it?
My daughter thinks it's pretty cool. My son, his automotive tastes have evolved more similarly to my own.
What a surprise.
Oddly enough, testosterone will do that to you. So, he tends to favor cars like ZR1s and GT500s more so than cubes.
Yeah, I knew he was in trouble whenever we were in the car and he was telling me that he only kind of likes the XK. I'm like, if I was 14 and I was sitting in an XK, I would literally be drooling all over the place.
No.
If it was an XKR, he might have, responded differently.
he's right, though. He's right on the money, because, I mean, the XK is, as great as it is, it's only kind of great.
Yeah, but you'd still pick an XK over a not XK 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, probably.
That's true.
That's beside the point.
What do you got, Chris?
Okay, I'm driving the 2006 Volvo without air conditioning right now, and,
Yeah, but we diagnosed that for you. You should be all set.
I don't know. What a pain in the butt. I detest this car, but at the same time, I really don't want a new car payment. I really don't have any clue what I want to do. And the reason I bought the S40 to begin with is I liked the simplicity in the inside. I liked the driving position, and I liked the way it handled. It wasn't perfect, but it's good enough for commuter driving. And at the time, in 2006, there wasn't much else that tickled my fancy in the class. And models from, 06, 07, there isn't really anything at all still to this day that I really like. So, other than the Mazda 3, which is like trading the S40 for the Mazda 3 is like, changing your penny loafers for a pair of Doc Martens. You're not really getting any difference there. But, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do at this point. If I'm going to keep it, get rid of it, it's very vexing, the taxing of my brain right now.
Well, how close are you to paying it off?
I'm like 11,400 from paying it off.
Okay. And so is it, would you trade it, or is it a lease, or what?
It's a lease. I did a long-term lease with the intention to buy.
Yeah.
And I figured, why not,
You're better off to just get out of that car.
It's funny
because
the dealer had more incentives on the car if I leased it and then bought it than if I was just to buy it outright. Originally, I went to the dealer to buy it, and it had $2,000 on the hood if I bought it. Plus, I had the Ford discount from my father-in-law, so I was going to get another $2,000. But having the if I was to lease it, it was $4,000 plus the $2,000 from Ford. So it was $6,000 off, and the lease price was only like $330 a month. And I thought, wow, I can get this great car for $330 a month, as opposed to the competition, what I was going to get. Stylistically, I wasn't going to get anything as good as it. And, drive-wise, as far as what I like, because I don't like big cars. And at the time, my option two was a Fusion, and I thought it was a little bit too big. So I don't like having a lot of car when I'm driving around all the time, even though I take up, 60% of the interior space, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, I would say
not that big though.
No, the Fusion's
right,
not
it was,
that
it was
much
bigger.
But
it was longer by like 10 inches than the S40. Yeah. So I was like, do I really want to deal with that extra car? And I decided not to at the time, even though the weight wise, they're only about 200 pounds apart. And the other problem was I couldn't get at the time. If you got, I wanted a stick, and if you wanted to get a Fusion with a stick, you had to get the S.
Yeah,
like not the SE or not the SES, and it had like hubcaps and stuff like that. And I was like, I'm not going for that. That doesn't sound like a good idea to me. And so otherwise, I was going to have to get an automatic, and I hadn't heard a whole lot of great things about the Eisen transmission, so I didn't want to go there. So I just wanted to get the manual, and I wanted to get the driving position, and I just stuck with the S40. But anyhow, let's move on to some news. We've got plenty going on, including the Autoblog redesign. We should cover that first. Basically, last Thursday, I think we easily came out with the best Autoblog that we've come up with yet. Some of the enhancements are you can now search by make and model, including vehicles that were reviewed. For example, if you wanted to look up 2010 Fusion, you'd get the review for the 2010 Fusion. If you wanted to look up the GTR, you'd get the review for the GTR that was published on Monday. So it's going to be nice for you people to be able to find things without using the search tool. And then on top of that, if they're trying to find any information about a car, if they want our opinion, they can look there.
Yeah, the couple of things that the users of the site have pointed out that we're still working on are the comment system and the search. And both of those come under the auspices of a different team that's still working on their job. But overall, this was a redesign, and we added the model pages and the carousel and cleaned it up, bigger pictures. I think it's way cleaner and just nice. It's more modern than even version 3, which wasn't outdated by any means. So,
right. And one other thing, there's still a few bugs in the site that our developers, the website developers, are working on. Some of the links on older posts to the galleries, the photos, photo links aren't quite working yet. And I think we may still have an issue with the iTunes podcast link as well. So if you're not getting the podcast in iTunes, we apologize for that, and we'll try and get that sorted out as quickly as we can.
Right, and unfortunately, when you have a website like with the size and scope of Autoblog, we could test it day and night, and there's so much information on that site. I mean, we post on a weekday, we do, what, like 28, 30 posts a day? And you know, take that over 4 or 5 years, that's how much content has to be put in. So as you guys go out there, and unfortunately, I mean, we find 90% of the stuff way in advance, and we get it fixed, and it's really close, but we know no matter what, inherently, you guys are going to find a few more mistakes, and we appreciate everybody who sent in tips to let us know.
Yeah, there's plenty of back-end work.
And right? Also, while we're talking about new stuff at Autoblog, this is probably a good time to welcome our newest addition to the Autoblog team, the wonderful Johnny Lieberman, who, as of today, as we're recording this, is officially a part of the Autoblog staff now. And we want to welcome Johnny, who's worked for a bunch of other sites over the past several years, and he's a fantastic writer, and I'm sure he'll be contributing lots of great stuff to our site.
Yeah, I hope
forward.
So. I mean,
yeah, and Johnny was a huge win, and I think everybody on the Autoblog team respected his writing and his perspective, and having him on the team is a huge plus for us. I mean, he's got the knack. He really understands and loves cars, which is a huge plus. For us, I mean, obviously we all love cars, but he's a very strong passion that's going to be a huge asset.
Yeah, it's great to have him on.
And in spite of his distaste for diesels, we'll welcome
him. Hold
anyway.
That against him. That, and he's definitely a part of the team in that he snubbed us on the podcast tonight. So welcome aboard. It's quite official. And
he's already.
We'll try and get him on next week.
He's already on top. I think he started to get a little intimidated by the amount of work that we do just to get it on.
Yeah, because
as far as like being on the phone and being recording and having a microphone and all the stuff that you need to have, it was like, yeah, I want to do it. It's that much.
Yeah.
Wow, we'll talk about.
Well,
this later.
We care about sound quality. Some may disagree, but we're trying.
So it seems like it was easier in 2 years ago when we were doing it, when it was just almost nothing, but we're trying so hard to perfect it now because we get wonderful comments, but we'll get it there. All right, let's move on to some news, and we'll start off with the situation between Volkswagen and Porsche. I mean, this has been a pretty odd story for the entire year. Porsche just seemed like they were in the catbird seat. Next thing you know, they're in financial straits. They're borrowing money from the company they're trying to buy out. Next thing you know, after that, you hear whispers about Volkswagen giving ultimatums and trying to get the company outright, and now it's happening. And the latest news is that Weta King was going to get a $200 million payout were it not for the Porsche union stepping in and saying that was too much money. So they obviously Vidakin was he needed to go to get this thing happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was very strongly opposed to merging Porsche's auto business with Volkswagen's auto business, and the Porsche and PH families definitely had to get him out of the way in order to get any sort of merger going forward and get the money transfer from the Volkswagen coffers into the Porsche coffers so that they could pay off their somewhere north of $10 billion in debt that they've accumulated over the last couple of years trying to buy Volkswagen.
Right. And I think you think about $200 million, and he actually ultimately got 50 million euros, which is about 73 million. It's still a ton of money, and he's going to give half that to charity, which is cool. And obviously, he's a millionaire many times over because he was the CEO for 16 years. But, I mean, if you look at his body of work and think about him in terms of other great automotive CEOs of the last half century, and his success rate is pretty stunning. I mean, the Cayenne, I think people like us aren't, in many cases anyways, that thrilled with that particular model, but look what it did for the actual output of Porsche and the bottom line of Porsche and help them to do greater things with, you know, the 911, which has always been great, and it just keeps getting better every year. I mean, he under his watch, the Boxster, the Cayman came to light, the Carrera GT, which is probably the most commercially unsuccessful vehicle because it didn't last very long, but it's still the awesomest. So, I mean, now the Panamera, which we looked at it, we boo-hooed it, it was ugly and everything, but every journalist that we've read comes back saying, wow, what a great car.
Well,
so,
you know, I mean, they wouldn't be around if it weren't for the Cayenne and the Boxster right now. In reverse that order, the Boxster first and the Cayenne. Both of those made things like the Carrera GT possible, and I think the Panamera, while we're not entirely sold on it yet, he's obviously got good instincts for where the company needs to go. I mean, you know, he's got a team around him as well, or he had a team around him. Now he's, you know, yeah. Out. But, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what the future holds for a reunited Porsche and Volkswagen. It's kind of, I don't know. It's almost like there was always that connection, but they were separate. And now that they're together, is it going to be more like a Lexus Toyota kind of thing?
Well, hopefully, Volkswagen will keep Porsche separate enough, you know, by combining the auto businesses. You know, there's certainly a lot of ways that they can save money, you know, in terms of purchasing, working with suppliers, and, you know, a lot of the smaller bits and pieces, you know, you can commonize those without any impact on the product. And hopefully they'll keep the product separate enough. You know, I think that they've so far done a pretty, I think they've done a pretty reasonable job with Bugatti and with Bentley and with Lamborghini.
And with Audi. I mean, everybody, they're the only ones that are any good at it.
Yeah. I mean, Audi, there's a lot of commonality between Audis and Volkswagens, particularly in the powertrains. But, you know, the other premium brands, you know, they've kept them separate enough. You know, there's some commonality there, and if you look, you know, you can find common bits and pieces, but, you know, they're certainly distinct enough to stand on their own.
So then does Porsche then become just another Lamborghini kind of in Volkswagen's portfolio? I mean, where does it exactly fit?
Times 50.
They're brand number 10 in the VW Group portfolio.
They're just above Skoda.
and Seat,
I think,
right?
They might be slightly higher than Skoda.
And I heard that on Auto Express that there's going to be a VW badge 911. So, I mean, watch your VW.
Well, it's the new
your VW dealer is going to have it.
Yeah, they're going to make it the new Beetle Turbo.
I think the Type 968 911 will be coming out as a Seat next fall.
Good call. Yeah, that's the beauty.
The beauty of the XAO.
The beauty of Porsche is the only overlap is going to be the Cayenne, and it was already there anyway. So really, they could do their own thing. And look at the great job they did with Lamborghini. I mean, other than the 5.2 liter V10, how many Lamborghini components are like, oh, that's from an Audi? I mean, that you look at it and say, oh, Audi, as soon as you see it.
Actually, in the case of the Gallardo, it kind of goes the other way, because when I toured the R8 factory last year, we saw them putting transmissions into the cars at one stage on the assembly line, and the transmissions actually come from Italy. They're built up at the Lamborghini factory, and the casing, cast into the casing, are both the Lamborghini and Audi four-ring logos.
But you know what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because the two cars using the same parts can be tuned differently so that they're two different flavors, and the bodywork over the top of it can be completely different, so it doesn't matter.
Right, and I mean, that's clear in the case of the R8 and the Gallardo. I mean, yeah, nobody's going to mistake those two. I mean, there's a lot of commonality underneath, but nobody's going to mistake those two as the same car.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I would like to have an R8.
Maybe you should trade
really?
The Volvo one.
Yeah. There's my follow up to the S40 right there.
Trade the S40 in for a Gallardo or for an R8, huh?
I wouldn't take one of those the Giorno press cars, even if it was half off. I would just imagine something
grenading. Especially not one with the Artronic transmission.
I wouldn't take any model that was brand new. I wouldn't get anyone with an S40. Yeah, exactly. If it was brand new, I wouldn't get it. It'd have to have a manual. All right, let's move on to the next topic. Basically, since Bob Lutz has quote-unquote come back, it's like he's been fasting since last November, and then we just put him in front of a buffet because he's just been a quote machine since he came back. And his latest salvo, and now he's running, I think, marketing and communications globally, which is kind of funny that they gave that to Bob Lutz.
No, I think he's perfect for that role. I think he's just phenomenally good. Just on a basic level, just hearing what he did, I'll let you go.
Dan, he's way too frank to be the head of communications.
But that's what you need.
Okay?
You don't.
He's way too tough. If any of the people that work for him told it like he did, oh my god!
But that's perfect.
All right, so
you know what's funny about Lutz is during this whole run up to the bankruptcies. Yeah, there were a lot of people out on the West Coast who were saying, you need to have a guy like Steve Jobs from Apple running, GM or Chrysler.
What a joke.
And well, yeah, but the funny thing is the with Bob Lutz, there's one aspect of Lutz, that's almost kind of like Jobs, in that when it comes to cars, Lutz has great taste. I mean, the thing that a lot of people have highlighted about Jobs, in his role at Apple, is his taste and his flair for picking the right products. And Lutz, by no means is perfect, but he has, compared to a lot of people in the industry, he does have a good instinct for what makes.
Yeah,
a good
and
product.
I think that's why he's
and
perfect.
So it's interesting now.
That's why he's perfect for the role of marketing, yeah, or even as a product guy, because everything he's...
Well, the product guy, yes. I think perfect product.
But yeah.
The point was, he's already shooting off left and right, and he's right here. He basically, we did a post on it on Monday saying that he crapped all over GM advertising. And that Buick advertising campaign is a flop.
Come on. Eni Kamosi.
An unabashed flop.
Come on.
First of all, the one thing that nobody noticed is I saw one of the commercials. They had the Chinese market Regal in one of the commercials for half a second.
It's also in a print ad for Buick, and it's actually labeled in there as Regal Concept. And I think the reason why they're showing it in there is because nobody at Buick will acknowledge it publicly yet, but I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that the Regal will be joining the Buick lineup within probably the next 12 to 18 months at the outside. There's no doubt. If Buick is going to be one of the four core brands, they need to expand their lineup at least a little bit beyond what they have right now, which is the Lucerne, which is at the end of its life cycle, the Enclave, and the new LaCrosse. And so I think what we'll probably end up seeing is the Regal joining the lineup, and also another smaller car based on the Delta platform, something like the Astra, like a Buick-badged version of the Astra.
I hope it looks like the Astra and not like the Cruze. It would be a mistake if they did the Cruze body style.
But
the Cruze body style looks great.
It won't be.
The Cruze body style looks great, and you know what I mean. And whereas, like the Traverse and the Enclave, they're very similar, I like, and Buick can get away with it there because that was more high end of the two designs. But as far as, you know, more classy, but they really can't do the Chevy design for a Buick. I mean, doing it the other way around works, but starting with the Chevy and then ending up with the Buick, not a good plan.
But, well, they've already got a version of the Astra for the Chinese market that, you know, looks like the European Astra, but with the Buick grille, just like they did with the Insignia and the Regal. So I think, you know, that's what we'll see here probably is, you know, perhaps even as a hatchback, a 3 or 5 door hatchback with Buick badging and a Buick grille.
Heck yeah, bring it, man. That would be awesome. All right, I think as far as the G, what could Bob do to turn marketing on its ear? I mean, obviously the marketing for GM, the dollars are going to be tighter than ever, and at the same time, it's going to be more crucial than ever because they've got to dramatically change public perception to get vehicles moving off the lots again. I mean, that's a huge job.
Well,
I mean, it couldn't be any bigger job right now in GM. I mean, I think it's even bigger than product development.
Of all things that he's done, he's obviously a car guy. He's passionate about the business, and that's shown from when he was at, you know, BMW, when he was at Ford. I mean, he's the guy that was responsible for the Mercur, the XR4 Ti, which is a fantastic car. That's him. That's Lutz.
Reliably and, absent, but
right. Cool okay, car. Sure. But I mean, it shows that he knows the product. And you need a car guy to talk to car people. You need a car guy to... Well, and the other thing that you need with a marketing guy is you need a strong leadership. You need somebody at the top to say, no, we're not doing that. Because otherwise you get all these brands with this confused kind of, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And then you got two different campaigns for the same brand that don't match and they're just silly. And I mean, I'm kind of like halfway related to marketing in the day job, so it's I see enough of it to go, that was dumb. And like, I don't get that photo shoot ad. It just, to me, it's like, what? And you know,
well, it doesn't sell anything, first of all. You know what it does? It sells the wonkiness of the commercial.
Yeah, well, it,
you
know, does, like, that
the making of commercials is
and goofy, it provides, you know, a new bounce, but to that song, Here Come the Hot Stepper from like 1995, that didn't really need to be like dragged out of the bin again. But whatever, you know,
I like, no, that song.
Yeah, you know, that's fine, we won't hold that against you, but you know, the ad doesn't do anything.
I think Bob, you know, over the last several years has put, you know, he's put a product plan in place, you know, as he was leading the product development side over the last several years. And so there's a stream of products that are going to be coming out over the next couple of years that were developed, you know, under his leadership there. And I think, you know, Tom Stevens, you know, will continue that. I think he's, you know, probably the right guy to continue that strong product focus on the development side. And, you know, now that Lutz is over on the on the marketing communications side, you know, I think if there's anybody who has an idea how to sell those, you know, he may be the guy. Hopefully, you know, I think he understands the product, and I think he can at least communicate what it is that's special about these products to the marketing guys and to the advertising guys. Hopefully, that'll happen. And another interesting thing that's happened, I don't know if did we talk about Brian Nesbitt last week?
No,
we did not.
Yeah, I mean, that's another aspect that's come out in the past week, you know, since Lutz took over on the marketing side, is, you know, the way they've split up the responsibilities at GM now among the divisional managers, where they've kind of split the sales and marketing responsibilities at each of the four divisions, whereas before the general managers of the divisions kind of had responsibility for both. Now they've split those among multiple people. And, you know, they put Brian Nesbitt in charge as the general manager with responsibility for marketing at Cadillac. And Nesbitt is a designer. You know, he's not a guy who came up through the business side. He's a guy who came up through the design ranks. And before he joined GM, he worked at Chrysler, also under Lutz. And he was responsible for, among other things, the design of the PT Cruiser. You know, and then after he came to GM, the HHR, and he's led... over the last several years, he's led North American design, reporting to Ed Welburn. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that Lutz has put him in charge of marketing for Cadillac.
Well, you know, sometimes it takes somebody that hasn't come up through the system to sort of effectively lead the renaissance, as it were, if that's what we can hope is going to happen. So,
right. The only thing I can think with Nesbitt is like, because he did the PT, and that was big, right? In its time, I mean, that was one of the amount of pent-up desire for that car when it came out in 1999 was just... It was obscene. I mean, a few cars have been like that before or since. So, I mean, but ultimately it died as fast as it got there, right? But then he came to GM and
It was popular for quite a few years before
fade. But it was 2 or 3 years of oh my God, I got to have this car. Then all of a sudden, there were rebates on the hood like the next day. So as soon as the fad died, it was rebates, right? So then he came to GM and he designed the HHR, which was not anywhere near the success of the PT yet. At the same time, due to the Chevy dealer channel and the immense power of General Motors, it just sold pretty well. I mean, fairly well, and it's a decent car. But other than that, I'm drawing a blank as to what he's done. I don't know.
He hasn't. Yeah, I mean, he hasn't been responsible for specific designs in his role in the last several years. But he has been. I think he's been in charge of North American design. So all the North American design teams have reported to him. He's led the teams that have created cars like the Malibu and the LaCrosse. What else have we had? The Solstice and, various other cars that have come out of GM over the last 5 or 6 years.
You know, when I looked at the new organizational structure, that was the one move that this, for some reason, didn't set well with me, because a design is such a specific role, and every time I've ever talked to designers, they're different kind of people, and not in a bad way. They just think in different terms than, like, for example, for an engineer. And I don't remember, we went to the Design Dome, I think it was about a year ago, Sam. We did some interviews, and just talking to the marketing people, like Steve Shannon, who's really great at what he does, and then talking to the engineers who wanted to tell me all about the all-wheel drive system, and then talking to the designers who did the LaCrosse. You could not have come up with different people. And my thought is, it on the outside, not knowing what Nesbitt's specialties are, and kind of talking from more of my perception only, it seems like they're just like, go play marketing for a little while. And living in Michigan, growing up in this town, you hear stories about, the finance guy doing marketing, or the accounting guy, getting tired of his job, and they give him a job in engineering. And you just think, well, how the hell are you going to make a car like that? And I don't know. It just seems odd. I know when you're in charge of marketing, you really don't have to market much. You just have to manage the people that do the job, right? I mean, you have to do an effective job of giving everybody a vision and a place to go, and that's pretty much the long and the short of it, and just make sure it happens.
Well, that's the key there, though, is that, giving them a vision, it's like, where do you want to go with the marketing message? And, maybe that's something different that that Nesbitt can bring to the job that hasn't been there before.
Right, and I think Bob Lutz, one of the things he called the Cadillac ads was too dark.
And he's right.
And I kind of agreed with that.
Yeah.
They are dark and drab, and it doesn't really sell the car. I mean, the hot chick from Grey's Anatomy.
No,
great.
All those ads sell is, again, it just sells like these BS little paragraphs about when you have the perfect car, blah-dee, blah-dee. What they need to do now, and what Bob has said they need to do now, is focus on selling the product. And, so maybe you're taking your advertising a half step down the concept ladder, where you're not selling this really high concept thing. I mean, it's bitten other automakers. Infiniti had an awfully slow start because of their stupid, like, rocks and trees advertising campaign when they launched the Q45. It was like, what the hell is that? So you need to be careful. You have to walk that line between, like, Sunday, 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 and just overly high concept that the agency manages to kind of ram down the manufacturer's throat. So,
bless you. I think you have to first say, does the customer really know what we have? And I think in terms of GM, the answer is no.
Right.
And if they're infinitely, like, for example, if you want to do a Prius commercial, you could have guys dressed up in creepy-looking suits with fake suns. That commercial creeps me out, where everything's turning green. You know, buying into the notion that, you know, you drive a Prius and you're actually, you know, deleting CO2 from the air. But the point is,
it pushes the product
commercial because people that are looking for Priuses know what the Prius is. Okay, I mean, maybe they don't know what it is, but the fact is, they know what they want. But when you go to a Cadillac, for example, do they really know what the CTS is? Because, and in some cases, I don't think they do. And I don't know if those commercials actually.
No, they don't. No. Anyway.
Right. So, all right, let's move on to the next topic. And speaking of Lexus, report coming out of, it looks like next year's Geneva show. The Lexus A3 1 Series competitor coming to Europe in 2010. Story from Autocar. It looks like a shooting brake, Sam.
Sure does. You know, it's most likely it'll be it'll be some variant of another Toyota platform, like maybe the Auris, which in itself is a variant of the Corolla. That's only sold in Europe. You know, if they follow the same pattern as Audi with the A3, you know, the A3 is basically a Golf Jetta under the skin, you know, with different, you know, different clothes, different interior, a little more upscale look. You know, and that looks like what they'll probably do with this, you know, follow the same kind of, line of thinking. Never know, we might end up seeing it over here as well.
Yeah, so I'm looking at this rendering, and it looks actually pretty cool, and except for the front end. The front end is starting to get more drab-looking. From the A-pillar back, it looks awesome. But the front end is...
The front's pretty generic, you know, current IS, you know, fits in with the rest of the family.
It looks good in the IS, but in anything else, it doesn't look that good. Like the HS250... I'm not thrilled with it there either, but it almost looks like an RX 350 on the front end. I mean, too much so.
Well, it makes it look awkward. It's just a rendering.
The rest of the car looks awesome, and conceptually, it's a great idea.
How trustworthy are these renderings from Autocar, too? I mean, I think the rendering looks great. I see what you're saying about the nose looking drab, but it's familial to me. I mean, it looks like a Lexus, so...
Right, but if you've got all ugly kids and you're going to have one more, you know it's going to be ugly. So, I don't know. It just, you know, change up the gene pool a little bit, you know? I know they want to, you know, keep to a line, but the new front end and the RX, I think people got... I was honestly expecting the new RX to blow me away because I like the old RX. And it looks more bland than the original RX, which was a real step back, I think, for that vehicle. It was like... The invitation for the rest of the segment to come and catch up, because Lexus owned that segment for so long. Now that front end, it almost looks pedestrian. It looks like, I mean, I could see what they're going for, and this looks like the top trim model of what we would see, and I wouldn't doubt if it looked just like this at the same time. But I say top trim because it looks like it's got like rolling on 19s, right? But
Actually, it's more like 20s or 21s even.
Right. I mean, but it looks great like that. I mean, that's the only reason it looks good. If it was rolling on 17s, it would not be an interesting car at all. And it would say, this should be a Toyota, not a Lexus. So other than that, I mean, it makes it look more low slung and a little bit wider. I mean, that's one of the cool things about bigger rims. It fills the wheel well and make the car look proportionally better. But I don't know. I think obviously it's a Lexus, so it'll sell. What do you guys think of what the actual design looks like, Dan?
I like the design. I think it's got a sporty edge to it, and maybe that's just because it's a hatch. I like it. It seems to kind of rear sort of echoes some of what I see in like the Volvo C30, and maybe that's just the rendering. But I think it's got a lot of potential for the brand. I mean, I think it's a good area to at least look at when you've got BMW moving. Sort of entry level with the 1 Series. I mean, the 1 Series isn't really any cheaper than the 3, but it kind of serves a different buyer. That's an area that Lexus might need to move into to continue printing money.
Right, and I think along those lines, some news from Lincoln along the same lines is, you know, that brand downsizing as well. And I think all the like the U.S. based automakers like Infiniti, I would say is kind of like that. Acura, Lexus, Lincoln, kind of Cadillac too. There, it seems like they're all looking smaller to fill more of a void and get more people in their showroom because people are looking for more fuel-efficient vehicles. And I think that's what Concept C was for Lincoln last year. And you know, I don't know that I like this design. I like the front end on this Lincoln, and I like some parts about it, but the fact that the car gets smaller in the greenhouse, it doesn't seem very practical, like we'd ever see that, right? So
I think it's super cool.
You know, I mean, they're like everybody else; they're facing the realities going forward of new fuel economy standards, and higher fuel prices. So they've got to come up with something smaller than the MKZ, which is the smallest Lincoln so far. The Concept C was based on the next generation Focus platform. You know, it's a front wheel drive car like the MKZ, it's an interesting interpretation of the new Lincoln design language. You know, applied to a smaller vehicle like this, it's actually quite because of the shape again. With the upright rear, it's actually pretty roomy inside. At least the concept was. And so, we'll see what happens if this moves forward to production and how close it sticks to this concept design. Recent Lincolns production Lincolns have stuck pretty close to the concept versions. So, something like this could show up in showrooms in 2011.
Is it possible to have the rear wheels that close to the boot?
Yeah, I think so.
Mini does it.
I mean, I haven't seen any that look that. I mean, that's what makes it look so cool because the wheelbase is monstrous and the car is small, and it's pretty big.
You look at a Smart. There's other cars that have gotten the rear wheels way back there like that.
Right. I think for that, for me, that's what sells it. So, and I like the front end in general from Lincoln. And I know some people either love it or hate it. I like it. And on the smaller vehicle, I think it looks better than it does on the really big vehicle. Because the smaller the car gets, the more I like the look. On the MKS, it's okay. On the MKZ, it made the front end look a lot better. And on this one, I like it a lot. So, and I liked it on the MKR better than any of them. So, which we'll never see. But
I mean, it's certainly a distinctive look. That makes Lincoln's the new Lincoln's instantly recognizable for what they are. And that's a problem that Lincoln's had for, at least a decade, is that, you see a new Lincoln. I mean, as nice a car as the LS was, you look at it and it's like, it could be any number of brands and it doesn't jump out at you as a Lincoln. Same thing with the MKX, could have been, from any number of brands, but now that they've got a distinct face, and they're spreading it across the lineup. And next year the MKX will get that look as well. I think it works for them.
I think the
only just as Cadillac's face works for them.
I think the last Lincoln before the newest design language came out with the MKS and the MKZ was the Mark 8. I thought it was distinctive enough looking that you knew it was a Lincoln.
Yeah, because it looks so bad.
With the headlights and everything, it was a pretty cool looking car.
No, for my money. No, but the Mark 8 didn't. The Mark 8 was almost as bad as that generation of Continental. But the Continental got better right before they killed it. They actually kind of tightened up the design.
Oh, the Continental blue. The Mark 8 I love from like... 90, the late 90s at Mark 8. Nah, the newer ones had the bigger headlights, and was it
with the bigger headlights? It didn't look good. It looked better with the smaller headlights. I'll give you that. But man, that car was like a melted LSC or something. It was just like they took the Mark 7 and made it bigger and dumber looking.
I loved it.
Oh well.
I thought it looked better than the Mark 7. I thought the Mark 7 always looked a little too heavy, too kind of bloated. It was like a heavier, bloated version of the T-Bird of the late 80s, which is actually exactly what it was.
Yeah, I was going to say that's what it actually was. But I also we were in the news in the last week was kind of Mercury's future. And basically they're saying they're going to cut the Mountaineer, which makes sense. Obviously, they're going to cut the, what was the other one that they're going to cut? The Grand Marquis.
The Grand Marquis is already gone. Crown Vics are only being sold to fleets now. You can't buy them retail. And, you know, you're basically left with the Mariner and the Milan.
Well, they're going to get a version of the Focus coming up, though.
For 2012, yeah. I mean.
Are they?
Yeah, that's what it said. It, you know, late 2011 or sometime in 2011. I mean, that's speculation, obviously. And I talked to some people at Ford, and they said that the Focus was coming late next year. So it's going to be like next November, next December, we're going to see the new Focus. So obviously the new Focus coming out, then it's going to be sometime in 11 before you see the Mercury version. Because obviously that's going to be a big volume vehicle for Ford. So they're going to want to ramp that one up right away. So it makes sense to have the Mercury version come in at a later date. You know, other than that, I don't see a whole lot of... I mean, they could have a version of the Fiesta. I mean, we've heard hints that it could be like the hip small car brand.
But what are they going to do?
Is that where the Ka goes? I mean, do you make a Mercury-branded Ka? I mean, I don't know.
What are they going to do, though, to differentiate... Like, well, I guess if they refocus Mercury on something other than, you know, kind of near luxury, because right now, you get a, like an SES trim Ford, it's going to be pretty close to what a Mercury would be for not a whole lot of difference in price. So what are they going to do with Mercury to kind of change that up? I mean, Lincoln, obviously, a Lincoln version of the same hardware is going to be able to command a higher... Well, going to be able to at least ask a higher price.
You know, when you start adding cars like this Concept C to the Lincoln lineup,
right?
You know, do you really need a car like Mercury, you know, in the same showrooms? I mean, do you need a Mercury version of the Focus in the same showrooms alongside the Concept C, which is also based on the Focus platform?
Well, I mean, I guess if the top hat is different.
I think the one thing is when the Mercury, when everything was Lincoln Mercury, and it has been for a while, I think the point is you've got to have something in the showroom that people could say, "Whoa, that's the model that I saw in the paper for $299 a month," and then you know, it gets them in the door. You know, some people don't know what they quote unquote can afford for a car. A good salesman will tell them. So, I mean, you know, they could say, "Well, you know, you ran your credit, and then, you know, I know you want this one, but guess what? You can afford the Concept C. Isn't it pretty?" So, I mean, if you're the lowest priced car in your showrooms, $35,000, is it going to be easy to get people in the door? I don't know. But
yeah, I mean the people at Ford, you know, they've talked about, you know, over the last couple of years, we've asked them repeatedly about Mercury, and they say, well, you know, it's incremental sales, doesn't really cost us anything to do, you know, to build them. You know, there's no extra engineering effort involved. You know, like the last unique, quote unquote, unique Mercury was the Cougar, and you know, everything else since then, you know, has just been a rebadged Ford. Yeah, okay, it gets them a few extra sales, maybe. But, you know, if you're going to start putting some of those same platforms under the Lincoln banner, then at that point, are you actually getting any extra sales?
Good question.
All right, let's move along.
Yes, let's move along. Good idea. All right, last story. Some rumors coming out of, looks like Japan. A two-door Prius on the way, a Prius coupe, and the rendering looks awfully light, a lot like the Genesis coupe. What do you know about this so far, Sam?
I mean, there's been rumors of a Prius coupe floating around for at least 2 or 3 years now. You know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Toyota were to build a coupe, something like this with a hybrid powertrain, you know, basically straight out of the Prius, or perhaps, you know, the version, the more powerful version from the HS or Camry hybrid, you know, with the 2.4 liter instead of 1.8 liter engine. You know, will it look anything like this rendering? I doubt it. I mean, this rendering, like you say, looks a lot like a Genesis coupe. Yeah, I think it'll probably look quite a bit different from this if it does happen. And I think, you know, one of the things that may influence whether Toyota goes ahead with this project is the potential success of the Honda CR-Z, which is going to debut at the Tokyo Auto Show this fall.
And it looks good.
And then go on. Yeah. I mean, you know, we've seen the CR-Z for a couple of years now as a concept. It's going to go on sale in Japan in February, North America sometime later in 2009, probably late spring. if they follow the pattern of the Insight this year. And so, you know, they'll probably take a look at how the CRZ does in the market, you know, just to judge, you know, how much demand there is for such a vehicle. And then, you know, probably move ahead. I mean, Toyota's shown several concepts. You know, they had the FTHS a couple of years ago that people speculated would be a new Supra, you know, which had a hybrid powertrain in there. You know, and they've shown, you know, quite a few different vehicles with hybrid powertrains over the years. So, you know, it's certainly possible. It's not not beyond the realm of possibility that they would do this.
It would be cool. It would give the Prius something else to brag about, other than fuel economy. I mean, coupes and fuel economy aren't something that you think go together so much. So, you know, it would be another way for them to sort of expand their offerings. You know, you've got a hybrid full-frame SUVs, not from Toyota, obviously, but, you know, they're going to start filling in every niche with hybrids at some point. So
right. I mean, they've already said they want to offer a hybrid in pretty much every one of their platforms by the end of the next decade. So, you know, and pretty much everything they build will be available as a hybrid or a conventional powertrain over the next decade. You know, if they do build this, there's also no guarantee that it'll even be badged as a Prius coupe. You know, it could be a new Celica for all we know.
That would be a better idea, I think, because it seems to me that they can already sell as many Priuses as they can. And I think if they had another winner, the caliber of the Prius, and not to confuse that with the Dodge caliber, I think it would be a good thing for Toyota at this point. I think they need to expand on the lineup, not the Prius lineup, because the Prius is already, and I can understand wanting to stay ahead of the pack, but at the same time, I think they, like, I like what Honda's doing with, you know, badging it a CRZ. You know, it's another model in the lineup, another feather in the cap kind of thing. So I would like to for them to go that direction instead.
Yeah, I don't think that the Prius, you know, the Prius name, you know, it's got a certain image in the marketplace. I mean, people think Prius, they think, you know, really high mileage vehicle, not necessarily particularly exciting, you know, or enticing to drive, you know, other than that fuel economy. And I'm not convinced that applying that badge to a coupe like this would be in any way beneficial to the coupe. You know, I think just the fact that it's a Toyota and that it's a Toyota hybrid, you know, people will get the message that, yeah, okay, this is a more fuel efficient vehicle. And, you know, they would probably be better off to call it something like a Celica than a Prius. But, you know, what do we know?
Right. And I think too, you with the Prius sedan or hatch or whatever you want to call it, I think they call it a sedan, but its usable space is one of the huge selling points for it. I mean, when you try to knock the Prius, it's like, well, you know, it's still relatively inexpensive, great mileage, not that bad a drive now, and by the way, you could fit a huge TV in the back if you're so inclined. So, I mean, it kind of wins everywhere, and that's the beauty of the Prius. And if you have two doors and a smaller back seat and a raked out hatch, you're not going to have any of that. So, I mean, people that are going to drive it more aggressively, you'll get poorer mileage.
Well, yeah, but you know that the first company that introduces a hybrid coupe is going to have that all to themselves, and that's what Toyota did with the Prius for the most part. They had the first practical hybrid. I mean, there was the Insight here that launched first, but
The CRZ should kill then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hopefully Honda beats Toyota to the market, and we see a death match.
That's going to depend a lot on what powertrain Honda puts in it.
I mean,
all right, let's go to the emails. We've got a few. I'm just going to read maybe one or two this week and then hit more up next week. The first one is from John, and his question is, when you started to add up the background costs of hybrids, and I know, Dan, you're going to have a comment on this, you know, shipping from Japan, for example, correctly pointed out that a hybrid does not pay for itself in fuel cost savings. You forgot some very important reasons for saving gas. The $250 we pay at the pump does not include the lives we have sacrificed and military actions in the Gulf. It does not include the monetary costs of the troops and the aircraft's carrier groups deployed there indefinitely, and it does not include the impact on national security of our dependence on hostile part of the world. I bought hybrids because I know the cost of a gallon of gas is far more than the $2.50 I pay at the pump in blood and in dollars.
Well, then.
That, I mean, he's absolutely right about that, but, you know, if you're... If what you're talking about,
well,
you know,
no,
we
I mean, doesn't
was,
doesn't most of our quote unquote foreign oil come from Canada at this point? Aren't they the
they are the biggest supplier of oil to the United States? Yeah, but getting back to what I was saying, you know, I mean, what we were talking about was the energy costs of both producing and shipping a hybrid from Japan. You know, if you factor that against the energy use, you know, for perhaps a conventional vehicle that's built in North America, you know, there's definitely a trade-off there. You know, I don't know the exact numbers. You know, I don't know if a Japanese-built hybrid that's shipped to North America is the total life cycle energy use is more or less. You know, it's something to consider. You know, buying a Japanese-built hybrid is, you know, not... You know, it's not a simple calculation. You can't just look at the EPA sticker number and say that, you know, you're doing something better. It actually takes a lot more investigation than we've done so far.
Right, and I think to the point of what we were saying before, and I think this still holds true, if you're mining down in South Africa for battery materials,
speaking of unstable parts of the world,
still using fossil fuels that are coming in many cases from the Middle East. I mean, that's the big picture. Overall, it's still taking up a lot, and I think just in terms of fossil fuels, there is a story to be told there as well on top of it. And it's cool that you had great intentions, John, when you bought your hybrid, and I don't doubt that, and I hate the fact that we're over there over oil personally, but I don't know that it's helping.
Yeah, you know, and the other thing too, you know, we're well aware of, you know, the fact that the price that we pay at the pump for gasoline in the United States is not reflective of the true cost, you know, and when you factor on all the different costs, and you know, that's why, you know, myself personally, you know, why I've been a proponent of, you know, gas should be more expensive in this country than it is, because the price you pay at the pump is not reflective of all the costs of producing that gasoline.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would agree that, you know, a fuel tax that could be rolled back into our economy in some way, not necessarily to stimulate as we're trying to do now, but just, you know, in terms of things like building infrastructure to really put our money where our mouth is instead of just trying to sort of in a flurry of printing dollars.
I want to alleviate a tax that's burdensome now and replace it with a fuel tax.
I mean,
that's my personal preference.
But here's the thing,
impact on the average American life is negligible, but at the same time, if you decide that you're going to use less fuel and less CO2, then as a result, you're going to be better off. If you say, screw it, I'm going to drive more than ever, I don't care, then it's going to cost you more. So that would be my personal solution. I mean, if you didn't do anything different, if you did nothing different, and they took away one tax and added it to fuel to better reflect the true cost of gasoline, like Sam said, then the net impact on their lives would be zero. It'd be more painful at the pump, less painful somewhere else. To me, that's not a win or a lose. It's kind of like a tie, except for people will start thinking twice before they buy their next SUV. They'll say, well, you know what? It's $5 a gallon. Do I really need it?
I mean,
and that's a question I wish a lot more people
asked. I think
ask.
People are going to come to that conclusion organically anyway, whether or not there's a fuel tax. I mean, things are just going to get expensive. We're getting squeezed.
The sale of SUVs spikes by 20%. I mean, now it's a small... I mean, when it jumps by 20%, that means extra five SUVs are sold. But It still happens. I mean, it's dumbfounding.
This is the United States of amnesia.
No, I mean,
you know, people have very short memories here.
Unless you kill dogs, and in which case they'll forget, they'll want to hang you.
Well,
forever.
Let's not forget though, they're popular vehicles. People want SUVs because they like them, whether or not they like them because that's what they've been sold, or whether or not they like them because their neighbors like whatever. People buy them because they like them and they want them. So okay, you know, when the price of fuel goes up, then they start to second guess their decision. But when the price of fuel is low, and it's been historically low, and it's been historically too low, then they're going to be able to justify it to themselves a little better. People don't always go out there like, you know, we're not a nation of dispassionate people. We're not a nation of analysts. As much as you'd like to think that we all kind of think things through, we don't, especially cars. Cars are a passionate purchase. They're a usually a frivolous purchase, because if we only bought what we needed, we'd all be driving, you know, something like an Aveo, or we'd be taking the train and riding our bikes, and you know, I mean, even simple things like we wouldn't start the car and let it heat up in the winter or cool off in the summer. You know, those are things that we just do, and it's behavior that you're not going to change. And so at a certain point, you just have to accept that, okay, we can tax gasoline more and that will lead to something. But on the other hand, you know, back to the issue of a hybrid costing, you know, blood and treasure. I mean, I think all cars do that, and it's not just cars. It's all consumer products in that sense. I mean, what drives our economy is oil at the lowest kind of level that fuels everything else. I mean, it creates our electricity. It I mean, look at China, and it creates all of that manufacturing that we then consume. So it's all this big interlocked thing. And if you feel like you're making a difference by buying a hybrid and you firmly believe in that, cool. I mean, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. And I, you know, I'm not personally a fan of hybrids because the way they drive, and I don't feel the need to make a political statement with my vehicle, and I think we're kind of ill-equipped to really talk too deeply about politics. So,
yeah, definitely ill-equipped. Yeah. Definitely. All right,
doesn't stop us though.
Honestly, the I, now that I look it over, the questions were pretty barren last week. So, guys, step up your game. but I did have one interesting comment that we got within the last past week is from Sean. Went on a 7-hour road trip from upstate Vermont to the middle of, I won't say exactly what he said, but it was somewhere in Pennsylvania, and he received a cup holder complaint from the other car. He drives a Mazda 3, and him and his three friends had the Mazda 3, and the second car was a 2000 Buick Camry. Haha, suckers. His car has eight cup holders.
Wait, wait, wait.
One in each door. Camry? Century, I'm sorry. One in each door, two behind the stick, and then two that fold down in the middle of the seat in the back. And Sean, how do you like that Mazda 3? But anyways, however, we drove from the Wendy's, the poor little saps in the second car, discovered not a single cup holder in that gold-colored boat of a car. Now, you'll never need eight cup holders. No, don't say never. For a car that's never been driven, you know, more than six people at a time, or I mean five.
Yeah, but you got to find some place to put the empties. So
exactly, that's what I thought. I mean, our car has plenty of stuff in the extra cup holders. I think the Edge has eight or nine cup holders, and we use them all.
Yeah,
but that's it. It was just he was more giving us a statement instead of a question, as per se. So that'll probably do it for the podcast this week. Sam, I know you get some house cleaning items that you like to mention every week. And I'd like to add, you know, podcast.autoblog.com. If you got any questions, give us some good car-related questions. We do get quite a few people who ask for more specific car-related topics. And in a given week, sometimes we don't get so much fresh car content. So if you guys introduce some more car content, we're happy to share it with everybody. And I think a lot of you guys like getting your questions read. So we're happy to oblige. Sam?
Just a few things. Don't forget, if you haven't done the survey yet, if you could take a few minutes, go to the podcast post on the site, click on the link and fill out the survey for us. Give us a little bit of demographic information and what you like and don't like about the podcast. And don't forget, Autoblog is part of the Weblogs Inc. network, which includes several other big sites with some stuff that you guys might be interested in. And they also produce some podcasts. You got the guys at Engadget who talk every week about all kinds of gadgets and gizmos and consumer electronics devices. And, of course, the video game guys over at Joystick, who produce some good podcasts over there as well. And I think that's just
I think it would be good if there are those of you who subscribe in iTunes. Yes, we know we addressed this at the beginning of the show. We know it's busted right now. We're working on it. But if you can leave some feedback and comments, reviews on the iTunes podcast, the iTunes page for the Autoblog podcast, that would be fantastic too. Good or bad, it doesn't matter. We take criticism well. You know, we ignore the negative, and
we do listen to the negative comments and try to address them. I mean, we've been working on our audio quality recently, and so you know, we do listen to whatever you guys have to say. So you know, give us your feedback on the iTunes page, like Dan said.
Well, for sure, we at least take it into account. Sometimes people get a little picky. Sometimes. Great feedback, and we take everything like Sam said into account. But if you say, "I'd like it if Dan was a different person," you know, so does his mom. You can't really bring that up, right? So,
don't we all? Don't we all?
It's funny because you could only get Sam to laugh if you say something mean. So, but you know, the point is you know we're at least listening.
Yeah.
All right, guys, that was another podcast.
All right, see you next week.
Next time.
See ya. We'll be right back.